So folks can contact the mayor that way. And again, I will just confirm the address. It's Twitter is at Mayor Ed Lee, MayorEdLee. Demand that Chief Sir be fired. If he's listening, that would be, if Ed Lee is listening and wants to listen to the people and realize that the majority of the people would like this police chief fired, that would be great for him to act on that. I'm not holding my breath, but more pressure definitely needs to be put on the folks in positions of power who do have some sway. So this goes to, this is connected, of course. This is from Countercurrent News, and this article came out, this was earlier in the year, and this is a police union targets whistleblower cop who exposed racism in department, and this is from February. A whistleblower in the San Francisco Police Department has been targeted by her police union for publicly calling out the department for what she describes as a pattern of racism. She says now she fears for her safety from other cops while on patrol. Sergeant Yolanda Williams was one of two African American police officers who were mentioned by name in a series of racist text messages that were sent by a group of fellow police officers. Those text messages emerged last year in court filings related to departmental racism. Williams is one of the only police officers to ever participate in the Blue Ribbon Panel on Police Bias. That panel was formed by District Attorney George Gascon after a number of incidents with the San Francisco Police Department proved they had a serious problem with racism on their force. Williams has also headed an organization called Officers for Justice, which seeks to out dirty cops and those with overt biases that prevent them from impartially doing their jobs. But Williams says these activities have made her the target of other officers and the San Francisco Police Officers Association. The SFPO claims there is no systemic bias among police ranks. They've even called out Williams for claiming otherwise, pointing to her by name. On January 20th, the SFPO wrote a letter that was directly addressed to Williams, which they sent to all officers who are members of the union. President Martin Halloran said in the letter, "Don't like some of the comments William had made in front of Gascon's Blue Ribbon panel. The POA is disturbed by some of your comments and accusations. For example, you claim that racism is widespread within our department," the letter stated. "The POA disagrees. While a handful of officers engaged in racist and homophobic text messaging, they were condemned for doing so by the POA and by me personally, there is no evidence that racism is widespread throughout the department." On January 14th, Williams had testified that she had witnessed firsthand fellow officers using racial bias in their policing. She had said, "This is a widespread problem and not an isolated incident. I'm black and I will never be blue enough," she told the panel. "I will never be able to prove to them that I deserve to wear the same uniform that they do." Williams said that since the letter targeting her, she has concerns that fellow officers will at the very least not support her if her life is in jeopardy. "It leaves me with a sense of uneasiness to the point that I am wondering how safe of an environment I might be in, and if, when I call for backup, how fast that backup will come." Williams says that the letter by the police union was a personal attack against me and my constitutional rights of freedom of speech. "It sends a clear message that when you go against what they believe in, you are then considered an outsider, an outcast, and they attempt to slander your name." So this was written by M. David and S. Wooden, and you can find this at countercurrentnews.com. And this was also came out before there was more racist and homophobic text messages that were revealed. So clearly she's telling the truth, and the folks, a lot of the police will not admit that there is systemic racism within the force. I have nothing to add to that. It's just really shitty. I applaud her for speaking up, though, and if more cops were to speak up about dirty cops, then a lot of us would have more faith in them. Although there's many folks who feel we could exist just fine without a police force entirely, and the idea that communities can police themselves and communities know each other. So that's an option. Moving along, how do I make a segue? The next few stories are—they're going to be on the depressing end. There's a positive. I'll do something that's a little bit more positive, so then we can go into the other ones. How about that? Before we talk about what's happening in Oklahoma, which is just like something positive. And often I think within the last year, I found that the things that are positive is just when bad things don't happen. When bad things that could happen end up being stopped, or something that's problematic that has happened ends up being undone. So it's like the story with the folks in Oregon who have been arrested for marijuana. Now they are being compensated for the time that they were sent to prison. If they hadn't been sent to jail in the first place, then, I mean, that's obviously what would have been the best situation. And the best that things that we can do is to somehow stop these really backwards actions from happening, and prevent further backwards actions from happening. And this is exactly what this is about, this next story. And this comes from the Charlotte Observer. At South Carolina transgender bill, South Carolina transgender bathroom bill dead. And this was, this came out yesterday, Thursday, April 28th. So the highlights, bill introduced after North Carolina proposal passed is dead for the year. But sponsor Senator Lee Bright, Republican from Spartanburg, will try to ban state aid to local governments that pass pro-transgender bathroom laws. Okay, with pro-transgender anything, it's pretty much just giving us the right to exist and the right to move about freely, identify as we identify, and be safe in the world. The idea that you would label as pro-transgender, it should be just like pro-human, pro-human rights. It's not this idea. The same folks go with this idea about how gay rights is like somehow people asking for special privileges when it's really just asking for equal rights. There's nothing special about it. It's just asking for equal respect. The way they frame these things. And also, I also just doubt anyone who, granted, there's a lot of miseducation out there, certainly. But for the folks who put these bills forward, I'm sure they're hiding something, because you don't go after people that you know nothing about unless you yourself. It's like you're pointing the finger at someone because you don't yourself want to be discovered. Like this Dennis Hastert guy, he was not a good dude. And all the meanwhile, he was molesting kids. So for the folks in positions of power who are out pointing fingers and wanting to deny other people rights, I would take a look at this Senator Lee Bright, who's apparently not that bright. Okay, next. Roads education bills make Sundays crossover deadline. All right, that's great. All right. And this is written by Toby Talbot. Oh, no, that was a photo. Toby Talbot from the AP. And then the article is written by Jamie Self. That's a cool name. All right, Columbia. A bill to prevent transgender men and women from using the bathroom or locker rooms of their choice is dead for the year. Sponsored by Senator Lee Bright, Republican from Spartanburg, the legislation will miss Sunday's crossover deadline for bills to pass from one legislative chamber to the other. Bills that do not have that deadline have almost no chance of passing this year. Lawmakers head home for the weekend after Thursday session, and as of Wednesday, Bright only had 4 of the 9 votes needed to bring his bill directly to the Senate floor for a vote. With his bill certain to fail, Bright was planning another way to advance his agenda Wednesday. When the state budget comes up for debate next week, Bright said he will try to add a proposal to ban state aid to local governments that pass laws requiring businesses to allow transgender people to use the bathrooms of their choice. Local governments that require that are telling businesses how to run their restrooms, he said. Bright said that he had high hopes for his no-aid proposal, that his no-aid, and I'm going to also say no-brain, like no-brain involved, no-thought involved, proposal will pass. We'd rather have the full bill, but we'll take what we can get. He's definitely hiding something. Go after this jerk? It's the best I can come up with. Bright introduced his bill after North Carolina adopted its controversial transgender bathroom law. In 2 days of hearings, supporters of the proposal were outnumbered by opponents, including transgender high school students and their parents, who said the bill could place transgender students in harm's way by outing them to other students, requiring them to use the bathrooms of their biological birth sex instead of the gender with which they identify. Even if Bright's bill were to reach the Senate floor, Democrats have vowed to block it. Well, good thing for them. Good. That sounded sarcastic, but it wasn't meant to be. It's actually a surprise. Like, good. Republican Governor Nikki Haley also said that the bill was unnecessary and going nowhere this year. Bright said Wednesday he would reintroduce his original transgender bathroom bill next year if he wins re-election. Let's hope he doesn't. 3 Republicans are challenging Bright in the June GOP primary. We're not going to sacrifice the privacy and safety, what a fucking asshole, of 99.7% of the population because 0.3%. I'm not even going to finish his quote because he's a fucking asshole. And that's why I like reading the news, because I can choose what I choose to say, and I'm not going to repeat anything that's really misinformed and hateful. It's pretty much, yeah, misinformed and hateful. And Liebright, for folks out there who want to do research on this ding-dong, that's an insult to ding-dongs, they're tasty, find out what he's hiding, because you don't go after people unless you yourself are... Why attack people? Why? Oh, gosh. All right, well, since I'm angry, I'll go to the next two stories, which are also will probably make you angry if you care about the world, and I would assume most folks who do listen to this care about the world, one would hope. So next is Oklahoma, as I mentioned. I met some cool folks from Oklahoma, and this is comes from the Daily Coast, and I've read a few other articles as well about this, and this was from last Friday, April 22nd, hashtag not going back. Oklahoma GOP House and Senate pass egregious bill on abortion. And again, these fucking men, like, more often than not, it's these dudes passing these stupid bills that harm people. And, whew, okay. Gonna breathe, gonna relax. Well, I don't know if I'll relax, but I'm gonna breathe. And this was written by Leslie Salzillo. I can't even. The words in my head are obscene. I probably shouldn't take to the keyboard, but then I probably should. To the poorly advised Democrats, liberals, and progressives who say they're not going to vote if their chosen candidate doesn't win, take a look at your fucking future. And that's their words, not mine. I'm not adding swears to this story. In a story earlier today, Meteor Blades writes, abortion remains legal nationwide despite being ever more hampered by forced birther machinations. It therefore seems impossible that a bill just passed by the Oklahoma House of Representatives to pull the license of any doctor who performs an abortion will pass constitutional muster. Blades reports the bill has now passed in the Republican-led House and Senate. It's now up to another Republican lawmaker, Governor Mary Fallon, and you can contact her and tell her not to pass it. And I'll read that about how you can chip in, how you can have your voice shared to get her to, not get her, but to suggest that it should not be passed. Under the bill, I feel like there should be like a wall to punch, or just punching bags, or just things that we can do to with our anger, because the fact that there are people in positions of power who are, all right, I'm going to read this bill, and then hope you're sitting down or breathing or doing whatever, because it's going to make you angry. Under the bill, any doctor who performs an abortion, except to save the life of a woman or to preserve her health, which would have his or her license taken away. The Oklahoma State Medical Association has opposed the bill, viewing it as an attempt to intimidate physicians and inject politics into the physician-patient relationship. I'm stunned that this POS bill would get this far, and I'm writing to call for action. If Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon signs it, she may very well kiss her political career goodbye. She's in a bad spot, damned if you do and damned if you don't. Compliments of the good old boys in the good old party, that's GOP, where extremists rule the day. But then, it was her choice to remain a member of a party that votes against women. To contact Governor Fallon, here is her office phone and fax. I am unable to find an email at this time, but when and if you call, please keep in mind that, although she is part of the problem, she did not create the bill, nor has she signed it yet. It is hoped she will do the right thing. And Governor Mary Fallon, if you want to send her a letter, I'll read the address, or if you're in Oklahoma, I don't, if I have any listeners out in Oklahoma City, or you know folks, go give her a visit. It's the Oklahoma State Capitol. It's at 2300 North Lincoln Boulevard, room 212 in Oklahoma City. I can send her a postcard even. It's Oklahoma City, okay, 73105. Call on the phone, 405-521-2342. Again, that's 405-521-2342. Let your voice be heard. If you have a fax machine and you feel like sending a fax, why not do that? The fax number is 405-521-3353. And then they have a quote from Susan B. Anthony, as there should be, I guess, in a lot of places. No self-respecting woman should wish or work for the success of a party that ignores her sex. And that's from 1872. Long time ago. The debate over our right to choose what's best for our bodies and our future will most likely outlive us. But we fight because it's what our foremothers and forefathers did for us, and it's what we must do for our daughters and their daughters. It's been said in different ways that anti-choice legislation will never end abortions. They will only create unsafe abortions. Be sure, we are, hashtag, not going back to the alley. And not going back is the only part of the hashtag. To the alleys after that. Here are 13 large and small reproductive rights organizations and social media groups to visit/support. they can offer information and or discussion about women's rights and laws against women. Planned Parenthood, NARAL, which I hugely support. I also support Planned Parenthood, but NARAL more so. Pro-Choice America, NOW, National Organization for Women, NAF, which is the National Abortion Federation, RH Reality, UniteWomen.org, Abortion.com, I'm glad that exists, Fight Laws Against Women, We Are Fuse, and that's F-U-S-E, Abigail Adams Brigade, Pro-Choice Liberals, Stop Patriarchy Now, and Center for Reproductive Rights. Also those last two, yes. The Guttmacher Institute is an excellent source of women's reproductive data and current legislation. Many thanks to Meteor Blades for reporting this news and for his continued pro-choice advocacy for women's reproductive rights. You can read the story here, and they have a link to that. And so we march on, and we are hashtag not going back. And you can find all the links to all these organizations on the Facebook page, facebook.com/weeklyrev. I think it's time for some more music. Here's another song that was performed, and it's kind of angry, but also has a nice beat to it. So play this music, and then we'll be back with some more stories, some positive and some... we'll find ways to make it positive. Any song that mentions wearing sweatpants, I think, is great. That was the band's called Andrew Jackson Jihad, and the song's called Hate Rain on Me. Next, we're going to have a story from The Intercept, one of my favorite places to find news, and this is written by Glenn Greenwald, whom I used to call my boyfriend jokingly. Met him once, and I dig his writing, and that he questions authority and just really stands up for what's happening. What's going on? So this comes from The Intercept, and you can find that at theintercept.com. New study shows mass surveillance breeds meekness, fear, and self-censorship. Amen to that. And I think that's kind of like what a lot of us already knew, and this just explains that a little bit more and extrapolates some more ideas behind that and why that is. And this came out on April 28th. That was yesterday. All right. A newly published study from Oxford's John Penny provides empirical evidence for a key argument long made by privacy advocates, that the mere existence of a surveillance state breeds fear and conformity and stifles free expression. Reporting on the study, The Washington Post this morning described this phenomenon: if we think that authorities are watching our online actions, we might stop visiting certain websites or not say certain things just to avoid seeming suspicious. The new study documents how, in the wake of the 2013 Snowden revelations, of which 87% of Americans are aware, there was a 20% decline in page views on Wikipedia articles related to terrorism, including those that mentioned Al-Qaeda, car bomb, or Taliban. People were afraid to read articles about those topics because of fear that doing so would bring them under a cloud of suspicion. The dangers of that dynamic were expressed well by Penny. If people are spooked or deterred from learning about important policy matters like terrorism and national security, this is a real threat to proper democratic debate. As the Post explains, several other studies have also demonstrated how mass surveillance crushes free expression and free thought. A 2015 study examined Google search data and demonstrated that, post-Snowden, users were less likely to search using search terms that they believed might get them in trouble with the U.S. government, and that these results suggest that there is a chilling effect on search behavior from government surveillance on the internet. The fear that causes self-censorship is well beyond the realm of theory. Ample evidence demonstrates that it's real and rational. A study from PEN, America Writers, found that 1 in 6 writers had curbed their content out of fear of surveillance and showed that writers are not only overwhelmingly worried about government surveillance, but are engaging in self-censorship as a result. Scholars in Europe have been accused of being terrorist supporters by virtue of possessing research materials on extremist groups, while British libraries refuse to house any material on the Taliban for fear of being prosecuted for material support for terrorism. There are also numerous psychological studies demonstrating that people who believe they are being watched engaged in behavior far more compliant, conformist, and submissive than those who believe they are acting without monitoring. That same realization served centuries ago as the foundation of Jeremy Bentham's panopticon, that behaviors of large groups of people can be effectively controlled through architectural structures that make it possible for them to be watched at any given moment, even though they can never know if they are in fact being monitored, thus forcing them to act as if they are always being watched. The same self-censoring chilling effect of the potential of being surveyed was also the crux of the tyranny about which Orwell warned in 1984. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment, how often, or on what system. The thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. It was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time. But at any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live, did live, from habit that became instinct, and the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every movement scrutinized. This is a critical, though elusive point, which, as the Post notes, I've been arguing for years, including in the 2014 TED Talk I gave about the harms of privacy erosions. But one of my first visceral encounters with this harmful dynamic arose years before I worked on NSA disclosures. It occurred in 2010, the first time I ever wrote about WikiLeaks. This was before any of the group's most famous publications. What prompted my writing about WikiLeaks back then was a secret 2008 Pentagon report that declared the then little-known group a threat to national security and plotted how to destroy it. A report which, ironically enough, was leaked to WikiLeaks, which then published it online. Shortly thereafter, WikiLeaks published a 2008 CIA report describing, precisely, it turns out, how the best hope for maintaining popular European support for the war in Afghanistan would be the election of Barack Obama as president, since he would be a pretty popular progressive face on war policies. As a result of that 2008 report, I researched WikiLeaks and interviewed its founder, Julian Assange, and found that they had been engaging in vital transparency projects around the world, from exposing illegal corporate waste dumping in East Africa to political corruption and official lies in Australia. But they had one significant problem. Funding and human resource shortfalls were preventing them from processing and publishing numerous leaks. So, I wrote an article describing their work, and recommended that my readers support that work either by donating or volunteering, and I included links for how they could do so. In response, a large number of American readers expressed in emails in the comment section at public events, the fear to me that, while they support WikiLeaks' work, they were petrified that supporting them would cause them to end up on a government list somewhere, or worse, charged with crimes if WikiLeaks ended up being formally charged as a national security threat. In other words, these were Americans who were voluntarily relinquishing core civil liberties, the right to support journalism they believe in and to politically organize, because of fear that their online donations and work would be monitored and surveyed. Subsequent revelations showing persecution and surveillance against WikiLeaks and its supporters, including an effort to prosecute them for their journalism, proved that these fears were quite rational. There is a reason governments, corporations, and multiple other entities of authority crave surveillance. It's precisely because the possibility of being monitored radically changes individual and collective behavior. Specifically, that possibility breeds fear and fosters collective conformity. That's always been intuitively clear. Now, there is mounting empirical evidence proving it. And I guess there'd be a pen drop, not a mic drop, but a pen drop, because that's there. Okay, so this kind of goes along with it. Sometimes I find when I do segues with these stories, it's kind of easy. It's tricky, because a lot of times I don't want to read these stories. And I still choose to, because not everyone has a chance to share their voice and to share their stories and what's happening with them. So the very least one can do is share what's happening to them and get the word out. This comes from Boing Boing, which is a cool site to check out. They have a lot of good articles on there. I've been checking them out for a few years now, and this is by Cory Doctorow, and this came out Wednesday, April 13th. In Texas, prisoners whose families maintain their social media presence face 45 days in solitary. Texas. Oh. And I know some folks from Texas who are in Texas. I visited once. Seriously, the state. I don't have anything to add to that. I'm just gonna read the story. I have a smile on my face because that will help me get through this massive injustice happening. And it's always intriguing. That's one thing about this show. I end up finding new ways for people to be cruel to one another and to hurt one another. I'd rather it be the opposite. Like, let's find new ways for people to help each other and to uplift one another. That would be nice. Maybe I'll find some stories on that. So according to a new offender manual from Texas Department of Criminal Justice, prisoners whose families maintain a social media presence to call attention to their incarceration will be liable to harsh punishment, including up to 45 days in solitary, loss of privileges, and extra work duty. It's another reason I want to get rid of prisons. Ugh. Mm. EFF does not oppose prison restrictions that target criminal behavior or harassment on social media by inmates. Getting to that point of the show where I'm starting to lose my voice. All right. Starting again. I'm going to drink some water first, because that's going to help the situation. That's going to help the situation quite a bit. All right. And I'm going to have some water first and take a little bit of a mini break. It's not really a break if you're listening, because I'm still here. I'm talking. What else can I say? It's a good day here in San Francisco. There's a big protest. Donald Trump is in town, and by in town I mean in Burlingame, and a lot of folks showed up to protest, which is awesome. So hopefully we'll have some clips of that for next time on the show. A lot of folks standing up against him. Not a fan. Oh, I got a quick story to tell that'll break the tension. Is there tension? No, probably just some sadness. So there's this, I was going to say operation, but it's a project called the Young Storytellers Foundation. And I've volunteered with them a number of times. And they have kids write plays. And the kids all have mentors, and they write plays together, and then they cast actors, and they take time to write the plays, but then they do the casting very quick. So we kind of showed up at like 9, and then we do a very brief audition, which pretty much just we go up in front of the kids and say, I can do this. So some people are more physical, some people are more like theatrically trained. I went up this time and was like, oh, I can play male or female characters because gender is fluid, and you know, I like to get that message out there to the young folks, because I feel like I would have appreciated that when I was young. Although I think now things have gotten a lot more, in most places, kids are a lot more aware of the options as far as gender conformity goes and how one can rebel against that and how it's all an illusion. Anyway, so we do that little brief thing, and then they cast us in their plays, and there are some really cool plays. It was really cool. One I was in, it was about, there's this kid like going from like a pink cloud to a blue cloud, and they end up combining it so it's purple. That's, I'm not doing it justice, but it was really awesome. It was really just, kids are right on. And then there's another one where they're like trying to save the world from this like really evil guy named Bill. Spoiler alert. And I end up playing Bill, and I have one line, and it's like I kind of walk on stage, and it's like, tall guy with blonde hair, so not me, but I was cast as this person. And he goes up, and he's like, I'm not really Bill, I'm Donald Trump. And then he gets like, he has like this cannon that like releases farts, and then it gets like, it backfires on him, so he gets, so Donald Trump gets covered in farts, and that was awesome. And so it was fun to be able to play that role. I don't necessarily see myself as a Trump-esque person, but it was awesome just to be like to inhabit this like jerk, because I do think he's a huge jerk, and his father was a jerk, and his grandfather was a jerk. It just kind of runs in the family, I guess. And the kids had this like, you know, really great reaction to it. So it was awesome to be able to be like, I'm playing this guy named Bill who's really Donald Trump who's a jerk, and to see him be the butt of a joke and to not win. I like that. I like people who are who are, you know, cruel and kind of and entice people to hate and to and be divisive and are mean and just very divisive and oppressive when they don't get their way. I think that's great. And if that had happened more often in history, hey, things would be a lot better off for all of us. All right, so now that I'm in a better mood, let's get me to a worse mood. Not a worse mood, but, you know, here we go. So we're going to read the story. How did I get on the... Oh, yeah, the Trump protest. So that's great that people are protesting that. Can't say ding-dong. Jerk. Well, he's a jerk. He is a jerk. And again, ideally, I like to live in a world where one can just uplift. Like, I like to uplift people instead of putting people down. However, when there are people who are causing a lot of harm, they need to be called out for what they are. So speaking of people being called out for what they are, let's see what these guys in Texas are doing. Guys. I'm assuming they're guys. I'm assuming they're men, because men cause a lot of problems. That's an assumption, and tell me, I'd like to see someone disagree with me about that. We'd have a discussion, but I think I'd be right. All right. EFF does not oppose prison restrictions that target criminal behavior. I'm going to start from the beginning, because Okay. According to a new offender manual from Texas Department of Criminal Justice, prisoners whose families maintain a social media presence to call attention to their incarceration will be liable to harsh punishment, including up to 45 days in solitary, loss of privileges, and extra work duty. EFF does not oppose prison restrictions that target criminal behavior or harassment on social media by inmates. However, a person does not lose all their rights to participate in public discourse when they are incarcerated. Supporters of inmates often use social media to raise attention about prison conditions and the appeal campaigns of individual prisoners. This policy would not only prohibit the prisoners' exercise of their First Amendment rights, but also prevent the public from exercising their First Amendment rights to gather information about the criminal justice system from those most affected by it. If Martin Luther King Jr. had written Letter from a Birmingham Jail today from a Texas prison, this policy would prohibit his wife from publishing it on his social media accounts. As EFF previously reported, policies like these have been abused by prisons across the country, most notably in South Carolina. Man, South Carolina, for a while, the state was doing well. You guys decided not to do the anti-trans bathroom bill, and now here you go again, just getting yourself into more trouble. All right, most notably in South Carolina, where inmates sometimes received more than a decade in solitary confinement for maintaining a presence on social media? Fuck that! Ah! Jesus, that's sick. Oh, and that's the end of the article. So, all right, it's 1:14, and that's what got me. I always find a moment in the show, not always, but quite often, where I just lose it, and I despair, full of lots of despair. Oh, that's so sickening. All right, here's something else. All right, this also comes from a super mainstream source, but the idea of this happening, I feel, is worth being discussed. AP Newsbreak, South Dakota tribe sues feds over ER closure. And this was written by Regina Garcia Cano, and this came out yesterday, April 28th. It's from Sioux Falls. A Native American tribe in South Dakota sued the federal government Thursday over the nearly five-month closure of the only emergency room on its reservation. The federal lawsuit filed Thursday by the Rosebud Sioux Tribe asks that federal officials be forced to reopen the emergency room at the hospital administered by the Indian Health Service. The agency shuttered the ER in early December, 2 weeks after federal inspectors uncovered serious failures that they said put patients' lives at risk. The lawsuit, which the Associated Press obtained ahead of it being filed, contends that the Indian Health Service, an arm of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, broke the law because an evaluation of the impact of the closure wasn't submitted to Congress at least a year before it was shut down, as required by the Indian Health Care Improvement Act. That evaluation must include several factors, including the quality of health care that would remain after such a closure, as well as the views of the tribe affected. It also requires the government to take into account how far tribal members would have to go to get care. IHS provides free health care to enrolled tribal members as part of the government's treaty obligations to Native American tribes. 35-bed Rosebud Hospital has nearly 13,000 emergency room visits during the fiscal year that ended in September, or had nearly 13,000 emergency room visits during the fiscal year that ended in September. Since the December 5th closure, patients have had to go to hospitals about 50 miles away in Valentine, Nebraska, and Winter, South Dakota. The lawsuit alleges that in 6 weeks following the emergency room's shutdown, five people died and two babies were born in ambulances on the way to the nearest hospitals. IHS's decision has caused the tribe and its members immediate and irreparable injury, according to the lawsuit, which lists as defendants the federal government, the Health and Human Services Department, and Secretary Sylvia Burwell, IHS, and its top official, Mary Smith, and the director of the IHS's regional office, Rear Admiral? Kevin Meeks. A spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services said Thursday that the agency does not comment on pending litigation. Former U.S. Attorney from North Dakota, Timothy Purdon, who left that office a year ago to specialize in American Indian law for Minneapolis-based Robbins Kaplan, has said his company is taking the case free of charge. The emergency room came under scrutiny in mid-November during an unannounced visit from inspectors from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who concluded that serious deficiencies threatened the lives of patients. Their report noted one patient with a history of untreated tuberculosis who was treated without any apparent infection control measures being taken. Another patient who was having a heart attack didn't get treatment until 90 minutes after she arrived. IHS closed the emergency room, citing staffing changes and limited resources, and now intends to privatize it, as well as those at hospitals on the Winnebago Reservation in Nebraska and Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. The lawsuit comes one day before the deadline for IHS and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to reach a last-chance agreement to address problems at Rosebud Hospital. Without it, the hospital won't be allowed to bill the government for services provided to Medicare and Medicaid-eligible patients after May 16th. The Indian Health Service, whose facilities bill Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance for care given to patients who have that coverage, historically has been severely underfunded. The tribe's lawyers are asking the U.S. District Court in Rapid City to require IHS to take sufficient measures to ensure health services are provided to tribal members. The lawyers argue that there is no rational basis or justification for the federal government to provide grossly inadequate health care to members of the tribe at levels that are substantially below and unequal to health care benefits given to federal inmates and others for whom it is required to provide health care. So, once again, the folks who have been on this land for centuries still being fucked with by the government. That's my synopsis, and glad that the folks are fighting back. And I think it's time for a music break to cleanse the palate, as it were, and I think it's probably time for some more Prince, because we've only played one Prince song today, and Pam is nodding in agreement, and that makes me feel good. So, what are some good ones? We played a lot of them last week, And I like playing ones I don't hear that often. There's so many. He was so prolific and wrote so many, and I like finding new ones that I haven't heard before. Here's one called Party Man. I don't think I've heard it, so we're going to play it, and it's going to rock, and then we'll be back with some more news.
Yeah. I am the party man. I rock the party like nobody can.
Your bass will be low.
Your high will be low.
Oh, hey, the new thing. Party man.
Say, baby, what you smoking?
Blow.
Well, here, let me light it.
Ow! You bastard, look what you've done to my hair!
My name is Ori Original, and this is how you make wheat paste. It's one part flour to four parts water. Boil 3 cups of water and mix 1 cup of water with the 1 cup of flour. You add your mixture and you stir slowly. Stir it until you get a nice, thick consistency. Let your wheat paste cool down and then pour it into a separate bucket. Using your brush, apply wheat paste onto the wall first, then apply your image, and then do a second coat of wheat paste on top of your image. And run away if you see cops. No. Just kidding.
All right, welcome back. That was Ori Original with how to make wheat paste. So folks went to create art and put it up. That's an awesome way to go about doing it. And before that was Prince with Party Man, a song I hadn't heard before. Definitely uplifting, and that's wonderful. Sometimes we end up on email. I can only speak for myself. End up on email lists. I don't know how this happens. I'm on a lot of Bernie Sanders email lists. Like, I agree with a lot of what he says. I don't remember ever signing up for anything related to him. And then now I'm on a lot of mailing lists, but still I find it's like every day he's like in my mailbox and I'm like, okay. Same with Jill Stein. Although I have been a registered Green Party person at points. I think I still am. So anyway, I get lots of emails from Jill Stein. And for folks who aren't aware, she's also running for president. There's more than just the two parties, of course. And so Jill is running on the Green Party ticket. And she's very much for super much most things I agree with, which would make, demilitarizing everyone and everywhere and giving money for education and protecting the environment and a lot of money for healthcare, just pretty much things that protect people and the planet. So I'm going to read an email she sent recently. Dear Roman, obviously not just to me, but that's what it starts with. The 2016 primary season is exposing a crisis of democracy in America. The prevalence of voter suppression, from voters forced to stand in line for 5 hours in Arizona to over 100,000 voters purged from the rolls in New York, is inexcusable. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, a federal judge has upheld new voting restrictions, including a voter ID law that will disproportionately block poor and minority voters from the polls. It's no secret that reducing voter turnout benefits the political establishment. It's time to bring real democracy to America by eliminating unfair barriers to voting and ensuring every vote counts. Join my call to establish a constitutional right to vote today. It may surprise you that the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly guarantee our right to vote. That's why establishing an explicit constitutional right to vote is critical to overcoming voter suppression. Across the country, we see people who do everything they're supposed to, yet their votes are not counted due to the negligence of election officials. All too often, these disenfranchised voters are disappeared from official election results with no legal recourse. An explicit constitutional right to vote would empower Americans to challenge systemic voter suppression and restore the integrity of our elections. If you're concerned about the wave of voter suppression, add your voice to the call to establish a constitutional right to vote. Voter suppression issues in state after state are symptomatic of an electoral system designed to prop up the establishment political parties. We see the same pattern everywhere, that partisan appointees control the electoral process, the establishment gains power, and the voters lose power. It's time to take control of elections away from the parties and put them in the hands of the people through independent citizen boards in charge of everything from voter registration to redistricting. It's also past time to discard the obsolete first-past-the-post voting system and adopt improved voting systems already used successfully around the world. The current voting system has most voters feeling trapped between two parties that are growing more and more out of touch with the American people. With polls showing record unpopularity for the Democratic and Republican frontrunners, we're facing the repugnant prospect of a general election where more votes are voting against what they fear than are voting for what they believe in. We can solve the lesser evil dilemma in a heartbeat. By anarchy. No, shouldn't say that. We can solve the lesser evil dilemma in a heartbeat by enacting ranked choice voting, which ensures that if your first choice doesn't win, your vote is automatically reassigned to your second choice, freeing voters to support the candidates they most agree with. And to bring real democracy to the United States, we need proportional representation, which gives you the freedom to vote for the representation you want, knowing that it's what you'll get. Countries with proportional representation, which includes most Western democracies, have significantly higher voter turnout because people are more likely to participate in democracy when they know their voice will be represented, even when they're in the minority. All of these reforms, proportional representation, ranked choice voting, independent election boards, and more, would move America closer to real democracy and help break the grip of the elite special interests who have hijacked our government. But it all starts with fighting back against voter suppression, and the best way to do that is with an explicit constitutional right to vote. Sign and share my call for a constitutional right to vote today. By standing together in our fundamental right to vote, we can build an unstoppable movement for an America and a world that works for all of us. It's in our hands! Jill Stein. Yeah, if you go to, I haven't posted this yet. I'm going to post it right now. You can sign. I signed. That's one way to help. I'm definitely skeptical. I'm not going to lie. I'm skeptical of the whole voting thing. Even the fact that like Jill is on the ballot, the idea that folks on the third party don't have as much say in the media, even Bernie Sanders, who's like, running on the Democratic Party. Oh, that's another story we'll get to. So I'm not a member of any of the Bernie groups. A lot of my friends are. I like my Facebook feed for the most part. It's like Bernie. So some Hillary, there's definitely some Hillary supporters there. There's some Jill Stein supporters. And then there's like anarchists who are like, fuck the whole system. And I'm like, cool. But there are Bernie Sanders groups that Facebook decided to like, cancel or just like get rid of, and apparently it's from the Hillary like pack like hired people to spam these groups with pornography, and friends of mine have reported this, so this comes like secondhand information, but people I know and trust have said that they received like people were spamming these groups with porn, and so then people would report them to the Facebook. And so Facebook had to take down these groups. And so like hundreds of thousands of organizers and Bernie supporters were then had their communication restricted on Facebook. And that's pretty gross. That's really, really gross. So with that being said, I'll add the Jill Stein thing in a bit when I can multitask. I can multitask, but I feel if I add it right now, I'm not going to be giving the show my full attention. So you can also just check out, where can you check it out? You can go to, what's the official place to find Jill Stein? I would guess Green Party. I'd guess you type in Jill Stein, Jill 2016. Yes. Jill2016.com. There we go. Problem solved. Jill2016.com. Jill Stein for president. A new society, a new economy. Hashtag, it's in our hands. And she also is inviting Sanders to cooperate on political revolution and real democracy, which is pretty badass. A lot of the times the folks are running against each other, and there's a lot of, like, people are attacking one another. And it's like, if everyone really wanted a better world, it'd be like, let's all learn how to work together and, you know, share our resources. And instead, it's a lot of people just fighting with one another. And that's gross and childlike and dumb and very regressive and reductive. And ugh, it's like, I don't want any of that. So it would be great if Bernie were to hop on board with Jill Stein, and if they could collaborate and share their resources and share their followers, because they stand for a lot of the same things. So I'll read a little bit from her page, since I'm at her page. Why not? Americans deserve real solutions for the economic, social, and environmental crises we face, but the broken political system is only making things worse. It's time to build a people's movement to end unemployment and poverty, avert climate catastrophe, build a sustainable, just economy, and recognize the dignity and human rights of every person. The power to create this new world is not in our hopes, it's not in our dreams, it's in our hands. Support Jill Stein's people-powered campaign. You can donate if you want to, and if you're able to. Join with thousands of your neighbors to build the momentum for real change. Support Jill Stein's people-powered campaign today. Anything you give will be matched dollar for dollar by federal matching funds. Let's read about why she's running, why Jill is running for president with the Green Party. Oh, and it's pretty much what I just read. We are being battered by unemployment and inequality. Yep, that's exactly it. So that's her platform, and hard to find fault in that. And I can find fault in a lot of things. I'm a bit of a cynic. I'm an optimist and a cynic. So that's great. So Target, I'm not into businesses, big corporations at all. However, when they stand up for good things, I think that's great. I'm not encouraging anyone to go to Target or to give them any more money. However, they have said that they are going to make sure that all trans folks have access to bathrooms, which should be a common sense thing. However, since they've said this, people are like gonna boycott Target now, and it's so people are so dumb. So this is from All Out, which is an LGBTQ organization, and I'll read a little bit about this. It's just dumb stuff. I almost don't want to give them any airtime because I don't even want to talk about them. But I appreciate it when businesses, even though I don't like big businesses, I don't like big corporations when they do the right thing, which is common sense. So I'm not even gonna read it. So, you know, that's. And I would imagine most listeners of the show are not going to go out and be overtly transphobic and in the face, you know, be like, that would not make sense to me. Although stranger things have happened, but there we go. Oh, no. Well, okay, first of all, there's two things to know about this. Back in the early 2000s, I've repressed a lot of this. From the years 2000 to 2008, it might have been because there were some people in the White House and people pulling the strings in the White House that made things terrible. So part of me wants to forget that existed. And I wrote a letter to him, to Ding Dong W, that was like, this is before they went to war. And there's like a lot of folks who were like, don't go to war. And I got a letter back that was like, oh, we have to protect the Iraqi people. And I was like, shut the fuck up. Anyway, so The World Can't Wait was one of these political organizations that was like very much against all that stuff happening. And I guess I haven't changed my name because the email is addressed to my old name and my old email address, which I still get. That's disturbing in some regards. But then they're saying that Bernie Sanders told MSNBC's Chris Hayes that he supports Obama sending 250 more troops into Syria. Do you think what's being done now is constitutional and legal? Hayes asked Sanders, noting the existence of a list of people that the U.S. government wants to kill. In general, I do, yes, Sanders replied. In 3 months, both the ruling class parties will convene to pick the next commander-in-chief. They're making preparations to sell wars of aggression, continued vast surveillance of whole populations, the whole catastrophe of empire. These unjust, immoral, illegitimate wars need to be opposed, especially when the eyes of the world are concentrated on these conventions. If you want to be involved in protests at the Republican convention in Cleveland, July 15th through the 18th, or the Democrats convention in Philadelphia, July 25th to the 28th, contact us. And they have a way you can contact them. Again, this is from The World Can't Wait! ! Stop the crimes of your government. Hidden costs of the U.S. air war in Syria. There is near total silence when U.S. bombs kill civilians in Iraq or Syria. Nicholas J.S. Davies, author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq, writes on the outrage continuing in Syria. as the U.S. increases troops there. At the very least, U.S. airstrikes have killed hundreds of civilians in Mosul, as well as destroying much of the civilian infrastructure that people depend on for their lives in already dire conditions. And yet, this is, by all accounts, the only the beginning of the U.S.-Iraqi campaign to retake Mosul. USA Today reported on April 19th that U.S. Air Forces bombing Syria and Iraq have been operating under new, looser rules of engagement since last fall. The war commander, Lieutenant General Sean McFarland, now orders airstrikes that are expected to kill up to 10 civilians without prior approval from the U.S. Central Command, and U.S. officials made it clear to USA Today that U.S. airstrikes are killing more civilians as a result of the new rules. Under these new rules of engagement, the U.S. has conducted a major escalation of its bombing campaign against Mosul, an Iraqi city of about 1.5 million people, which has been occupied by Islamic State since 2014. Reports of hundreds of civilians killed in U.S. airstrikes reveal some of the human cost of the U.S. air war and the new rules of engagement. Oof. Okay. Next.